Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and now partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From an article by J.D. Powers in DSNews.com, consumers growing more dissatisfied with lenders. The average time required to approve and close a loan has increased in 2009 compared with 2008, fueling a decline in overall customer satisfaction with primary mortgage lenders, according to J.D. Power and Associates. The global marketing information firm reported that the average time required to approve and close a loan has increased to nearly 47 days compared with 30 days in 2008, primarily due to increased scrutiny of loan applications and higher origination volumes driven by increases in refinancing. J.D. Power's survey of more than 3,400 consumers who originated new mortgages within the previous 12 months showed the overall satisfaction decline 2.4% to a reading of 739 on a 1,000-point scale. Branch Banking and Trust, BB&T, ranks highest among primary mortgage lenders with a score of 783. According to J.D. Power, BB&T performs particularly well in the application approval process and closing of new loans. Customers working with BB&T indicate they have a better idea of the steps involved in all aspects of the mortgage origination process and the time it will take to complete each one, said David Lowe, Director of Financial Services at J.D. Power and Associates. Customers report that BB&T effectively manages customer expectations around standard process-related elements. Wachovia follows in the rankings with a score of 781, while National City Mortgage and SunTrust Mortgage ranked third, each with a score of 769. Wells Fargo, Flagstar Bank, GMAC Mortgage, and Bank of America also had better than average scores. The lowest score was given to the now-defunct Taylor, Bean & Whitaker Mortgage Corp. Citigroup received the second lowest score. J.D. Power's study also showed that lending criteria has tightened with credit scores now higher among mortgage customers and more applicants being asked to provide additional documentation compared to previous surveys. While the more cautious approach to underwriting mortgages is justified, the longer turn times and more numerous requests for information tend to have a negative impact on satisfaction, Lowe said. Good underwriting and delivering a satisfying customer experience are not mutually exclusive, and some of the negative effects of a tightened lending environment can be mitigated by simply improving communication between lenders and customers. Again, that was an article from DSNews.com. Another update is that GMAC fires its CEO and asks for $5.6 billion more from the Treasury. GMAC replaced chief executive as it negotiates for more aid. The troubled auto and home lender, GMAC Financial Services, said Monday that chief executive Alvaro de Molina is stepping down and that Michael Carpenter, a member of the company's board of directors, has been named his successor. A bankruptcy colleague of mine, Carl H. Starrett from California, has issued a note for all of the debtors to be aware of debt collectors. He indicated that in August 2009, the Better Business Bureau issued a nationwide alert warning consumers about phony debt collectors threatening to arrest them for not repaying a payday loan. Carl decided to investigate a little further after the daughter of a bankruptcy client of his called after receiving one of these phone calls. Attorney Sterrett got the phone number from which the call was made and returned the call. He wrote that the person answering the phone sounded like he was from an overseas call center, but claimed to be an attorney named Steve Austin with the Riverside County Criminal Defense Office. When Carl asked for his bar number and street address, Mr. Austin stated that his bar number was confidential and the address he gave was in Los Angeles. Carl noted that Riverside is in a completely different county than Los Angeles, which was yet another warning sign that this was a scam. Carl also did a check on Mr. Austin and discovered that he is not admitted to practice law in California. When more deeply interrogated, Mr. Austin claimed that he was admitted to practice in Texas and Florida rather than California. So the important point is that it is not uncommon anymore for debt collectors and scammers to use false information or make illegal threats in order to collect a debt. Anyone feeling that something is inappropriate should check with their state government sites to see if there is anything to do if one is a victim of a phony or harassing debt collector. And of course, you should also seek the assistance of a local attorney who specializes in debt relief to help you. It's very important during this kind of attempt at debt collection that you're not bullied into action. If you receive any kind of suspicious telephone call about collecting an outstanding debt, the first thing you always need to do is ask the debt collector to provide official documentation that substantiates the debt. Also, do not provide or confirm any bank account, credit card, or other personal information over the telephone until you confirm the legitimacy of the call. If you believe that a debt collector is trying to scam you, as I said, try to contact your state or a private attorney, but you can also file an abuse complaint with the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, online at www.ftc.gov. Again, that's www.ftc.gov, or by telephone at 202-326-2222. Again, that's 202-326-2222. And finally, you can also file a complaint with your Better Business Bureau at www.bbb.org. Again, www.bbb.org, or by telephone, 203-269-2700. 203-269-2700, and its extension 2. This is becoming more and more typical that these debt collectors are actually con people, threatening loan holders of defaulting and claiming that they are being sued. The imposters threaten the loan holders with imminent arrest and extradition to California, which seems to be backing this kind of process somewhat, of allowing police departments' names and sheriff's names to be used. And the con artist is saying they will not relent unless $1,000 is being wired to them or the victim is willing to provide bank account or credit card information. So you have to be very, very careful here. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, in the second portion of the show, I'd like to continue with my discussion of the two-income trap, which is why middle-class mothers and fathers are going broke. It's based on a text by Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi. And I want to give my start-off credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these series of programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who I suggest are two of America's leading champions for debtors. They have two very practical books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. I also suggest that people can get a lot of review on what has been going on in the debt world by going back on the shows that I have produced at www.kruufm.com. Look in the archives under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all the shows, which would really enlighten your thinking quite a lot on dealing with debt. Just to start out with a little review of what I was discussing last week, it was the bidding war in the suburbs. It seems that middle-class American families have been quietly drawn into what we look at as a war, really an all-out war. And it's not a war on drugs or the war on creationism or the war over sex education. This war really has received very little coverage in the press and practically no attention at all from politicians. But it has profoundly altered the lives of parents everywhere, shaping practically every economic decision that they make. The war is what Professor Warren calls a bidding war, and it has to do with bidding for homes. It started out with individual parents seeking out homes they thought were good places to bring up kids, just as the parents had done historically. But as the family saw urban centers as increasingly unattractive places to live, the range of desirable housing options began to shrink, and parents' desire to escape from failing schools began to take on a new kind of urgency. Across this land, millions of parents joined in the search for a house on the safe side of the street with a good school nearby. What occurred was that over time, the demand heated up for an increasingly narrow slice of the housing stock. As Professor Warren points out, this in itself would have been enough to trigger a bidding war for suburban homes in good school districts, but a growing number of families brought new artillery to the war. And what's that? A second income. In an era when the overwhelming majority of mothers are bringing home a paycheck and covering a big part of the family's bills, it's easy to forget that just one generation ago, most middle-class mothers, including those in the workforce, made only modest contributions to the family's regular expenses. And there are some very important reasons for this. A generation ago, the average working wife contributed just one quarter of the family's total income, based on the data. In most families, mom's earnings were treated just as what could be called pin money to cover treats and extras, not for mortgages, not for car payments, not for the bare necessities that we had discussed in prior shows, the basic needs of the family. And it's important to recognize that this did not come just because of some feminism prejudice or thick-skulled husbands and their unenlightened treatment of their wives, fostering a kind of terrible attitude towards women. Actually, banks and loan companies routinely ignored women's earnings in calculating whether to approve a mortgage, on the theory that a wife might leave the workforce at any moment to pursue full-time homemaking. It was just a very practical, historical, economic choice by the banks. But then a very huge change took place. In 1975, Congress passed an important law with far-reaching consequences for families' housing choices. The law is called the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and it stipulated, among other things, that lenders could no longer ignore a wife's income when judging whether a family earned enough to qualify for a mortgage. Now that changes the entire equation. By the early 1980s, women's participation in the labor force had become a significant factor in whether a married couple could buy a home. Both families and banks had started down the path of counting mom's income as an essential part of the monthly budget. So now it was factored into the bare necessities. The subsistence values, the mortgage, the car payments, which up until then were not only paid for by the husband's income, but created a planning system in the family on how to deal with the finances. In fact, this meant that the expanding capabilities of a family were actually limited to what the father was making. In other words, it was a very conservative approach to the family income. But now the Equal Credit Opportunity Act changed that thinking. Of course, this change may not sound revolutionary today, but it represents a seismic shift in family economics. No longer were families constrained by dad's earning capacity. When mom wanted a bigger yard or dad wanted a better school for the kids, families had a new answer. Send mom to work and use her paycheck to buy that nice house in the suburbs or that new car, and etc. with respect to the bare necessities.
When we step back from the whole thing and look at it, we recognize that the women's movement contributed to the trend. They opened up new employment possibilities and called on mothers to reconsider their lifetime goals. For many women, the decision to head into the workplace meant real personal fulfillment and expanded opportunities to engage in interesting, challenging occupations. The sense of independence that accompanied a job and a paycheck provided a real powerful incentive for women. But for most middle-class women, the decision to get up early, drop the children off at daycare, and go to the office or factory was driven by one very basic attempt. Millions of women wanted to give their families an economic edge. According to the two-income trap, the transformation happened gradually as hundreds of thousands of mothers marched into the workforce year after year. But over the course of just a few decades, the change has been nothing short of revolutionary. As recently as 1976, a married mother was more than twice as likely to stay home with her children as to work full-time. But by the year 2000 and the turn of the century, those figures had almost reversed. The modern married mother is now nearly twice as likely to have a full-time job as to stay home. So obviously that is a huge shift. But this kind of transformation can be felt in other basic ways. For instance, in 1965, only 21% of working women were back at their jobs within 6 months of giving birth to their first child. Today, that figure is higher than 70%. Also, a modern mother with a three-month-old infant is more likely to be working outside the home than was a 1960s woman with a five-year-old child. For many women today, it never occurs to them not to work, even after the birth of a child. It's just taken for granted that women have jobs. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So I've been talking about the shift of women into the workforce in the last generation. Just to repeat, in 1976, a married woman was more than twice as likely to stay home with their children as to work full-time, but by the turn of the century, that figure had reversed, with modern married mother being nearly twice as likely to have a full-time job as to stay at home. And also in 1965, only 21% of working women were back at their jobs
within 6 months of giving birth to their first child, whereas today that figure is higher than 70%. But these are statistics, and even these statistics somewhat understate the magnitude of change among middle-class mothers. Before the 1970s, large numbers of older women, lower-income women, and childless women were in the workforce. But the middle-class mothers were far more likely to stay behind, really holding on to what is called the more traditional role of full-time homemaker, long after many of their sisters had given it up. But over the past generation, middle-class mothers have flooded into offices, shops, factories, and they're undergoing a greater increase in workforce participation than either their poor or their well-to-do sisters. So that's a big change.
Also, basic attitudes started changing as well. In 1970, when the women's revolution was well underway, 78% of younger married women thought that it was better for wives to be homemakers and husbands to do the breadwinning. And that's a statistical fact. Now, today, on the other hand, only 38% of women believe that it is ideal for one parent to be full-time, and nearly 70% of Americans believe it doesn't matter whether it is the husband or the wife who stays home with the children. It's also the middle-class family whose finances have been most profoundly affected by women's entry into the workforce. Unfortunately, poorer, less educated women have seen small gains in real wages over the past generation. Wealthy women, on the other hand, have enjoyed considerable increases, but those gains were complemented by similar increases in their husbands' rapidly rising incomes. For middle-class women, however, the woman's growing paychecks have made all the difference. And this compensates for the painful fact that their husband's earnings have stagnated over the past generation. That's the truth in the middle class. So now let's get back to the bidding wars. Getting that house. For millions of middle-class families hoping to hold on to a more traditional mother-at-home lifestyle, well, just do the math. The bidding wars crushed those kinds of dreams because of the family income. Professor Warren uses our nation's police force, the officers, to illustrate the point. A study showed that the average police officer could not afford a median-priced home in 2/3 of the nation's metropolitan areas on the officer's income alone. The data shows that the same is true for elementary school teachers, and that this phenomenon is not limited to high-cost cities such as New York and San Francisco. Without a working spouse, the family of a police officer or teacher is forced to rent an apartment or buy in a marginal neighborhood, even in more modestly priced cities, such as perhaps Nashville, Kansas City, or Charlotte. So the conclusion was that families found that in order to hold on to all the benefits of a stay-at-home mom, they will be shoved to the bottom rungs of the middle class, not where they wanted to go. Now that raises another question. What about those families with middle class aspirations who earned a little less than average, or those who lived in a particularly expensive city? Again, the data shows that even with both parents in the workforce, they have fallen behind. What did these families do? Well, rather than drop out of the bidding war and resign themselves to sending their kids to weaker schools, many middle-class couples have discovered another way to fund their dream home. What's that? You take on a bigger mortgage. If we look at 1980, the mortgage lending industry was effectively deregulated. What's the result of that? Well, with that deregulation, the average family could find plenty of banks willing to issue them larger mortgages relative to their incomes. Now, this is much more of a weapon in the bidding war.
wanting to put their kids in a safe neighborhood in a very good school district. Families took on larger and larger mortgages just to keep up, committing themselves to debt loads that were, frankly, unimaginable. And that was just a tool in building the American dream. So now what do we have? We have the extra income from mom's paycheck and extra mortgage money from the bank. So the usual supply and demand in the market for homes exploded into an all-out bidding war. And this, of course, was in the desirable areas, which again is the safe neighborhood and the neighborhood where the good schools are located. It may not make sense mathematically, as millions of families sent a second earner into the workforce. You might expect that they would spend less on housing as a proportion of their total income, but just the opposite occurred. A growing number of middle-class families now spend more on housing relative to family income. As the demand for the limited stock of desirable housing continued to grow, prices did not reach the natural limit that would have been imposed by purchasing power of the single-income family confined to a conventional, as we saw, the 80% mortgage. What happened? Well, monthly mortgage expenses took a leap of 69% at a time that the other family expenditures like food, clothing, home furnishings, etc., remained steady or fell. In sum, parents were caught. It may have been their collective demand for housing in family neighborhoods drove the prices up, but each individual family wanted one of those houses, and they had no choice but to join in the bidding war. If a family refused to pay, some other family would have snatched up the property. It was just a spiral. Not one single family could overcome the effects of, frankly, millions of other families wanting what it wanted. So over time, each year, a growing number of stay-at-home mothers made the move into the workforce, hoping to put their families into solidly middle-class neighborhoods. But actually, the rules had quietly changed. Today, working mothers aren't working to get ahead. Now, they're working just to keep up. This is what Professor Warren has defined as the trap, the two-income trap, and a terrible trap at that. And we'll continue by thinking next week about getting out of the housing trap. Is it possible for families to extract themselves from the two-income housing trap? Can families downshift, taking on no more mortgage debt than they could afford? Well, there are certainly some financial aspects to it that seem very, very sensible, which we will continue to discuss. But also remember that the problem is families don't always use money as the issue, which is often very good, but here it could be a challenge. People don't want to rent for another 10 years or live in a neighborhood with lousy schools. That's just part of their thinking, which is perhaps very good, but it can be a problem, and we will continue to analyze this next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I am speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.